With those good thoughts in mind, please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, dearest Mother, beloved David, Saints and sages of all religions, I bow to you all. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen.
So we're going to continue tonight what we were talking about last week, which is as a man thinketh. And this is a phrase taken from Proverbs in the Bible. And the idea is that as a man thinketh, so is he. And so that we are a product of our thoughts. And the man that wrote this is his name is James Allen. And one of the things that the saints and our spiritual teachers tell us is that to align ourselves more with God and God's wisdom, to keep our minds on God, there's several things that we can do. And I'm just going to mute you here, Joshua. There we go. And there's several things that we can do, and we can keep our minds on God. We can meditate. We can pray. And we can seek out the company of spiritual masters. And that's, of course, what we naturally gravitate towards. That's what drew us to Mother. It's what drew us to David. And so we can take the wisdom of highly realized individuals from saints. And the reason that I was drawn to this book and the one that introduced me to this book is David himself. And David loved the wisdom of James Allen. And in this book, published by Blue Dove Press down in San Diego, a friend of ours and a friend of Prem's, he's got five books in one little compilation here. And we're just going over the first one. Perhaps one of the most important ones, and that is As a Man Thinketh. So we're going to pick up where we left off last week. And this chapter is called The Effective Thought on Health and the Body. And we tend to spend a lot of time sometimes thinking about our bodies, trying to get the right nutrition, trying to not eat the bad things and eat more of the good things. To take vitamins, to take supplements. And sometimes we don't put as much focus on the effective thought on health in the body. And so this is kind of a fascinating chapter in that sense. So here's what James Allen has to say. He says, the body is the servant of the mind. It obeys the operations of the mind, whether they be deliberately chosen or automatically expressed. At the bidding of unlawful thoughts, the body sinks rapidly into disease and decay. At the command of glad and beautiful thoughts, it becomes clothed with youthfulness and beauty. Disease and health, like circumstances, are rooted in thought. Sickly thoughts will express themselves through a sickly body. Thoughts of fear have been known to kill a man as speedily as a bullet. And they are continually killing thousands of people just as surely, though less rapidly. The people who live in fear of disease are the people who get it. Anxiety quickly demoralizes the whole body and lays it open to the entrance of disease, while impure thoughts, even if not physically indulged, soon will shatter the nervous system. Strong, pure, and happy thoughts build up the body in vigor and grace. The body is a delicate and pliable instrument, which responds readily to thoughts by which it is impressed. And habits of thought will produce their own effects, good or bad, upon it. Men will continue to have impure and poisoned blood as long as they propagate unclean thoughts. Out of a clean heart comes a clean life and a clean body. Out of a defiled mind proceeds a defiled life and a corrupt body. Thought is the fountain of action, life, and manifestation. Make the fountain pure, and all will be pure. Change of diet will not help a man who will not change his thoughts. When a man makes his thoughts purer, he no longer desires impure food. You know, this reminds me of something that Master said one time. He was talking to a new devotee, and he said, I'm not going to prohibit you from, taking in certain things. But what you'll find is that as you meditate and as you start to purify your thoughts and as you start rising in spiritual consciousness, your desire for alcohol, your desire for cigarettes, your desire to eat, heavy foods, a lot of meat, perhaps hamburgers. He says, I cannot guarantee that those won't fall away just of their own volition as you purify your thoughts. So this is interesting. And if you think about the whole premise of what James Allen is saying here, is that it's really everything originates in the causal. Everything in this universe that we can see, feel, hear, and touch originates as a thought. And we are in control of our thoughts, even though we sometimes don't think we are. Thoughts come to us unbidden, and they pop into our minds. But James Allen's assertion is that with discipline and with focusing on our thoughts, with paying attention to what comes to us, with cultivating the right thoughts, we can control the outcomes in our life to a great extent, including the health and vigor of our bodies. So he goes on to say that clean thoughts make clean habits. The so-called saint who does not wash his body is not a saint. He who has strengthened and purified his thoughts does not need to consider the malevolent microbe. Your mind determines your health. If you would perfect your body, guard your mind. If you would renew your body, beautify your mind. The thoughts of malice, envy, disappointment, despondency rob the body of its health and grace. A sour face does not come by chance. It is made by sour thoughts. Wrinkles that mar are drawn by folly, passion, and pride. He says he knows of a woman of 96 years old who has the bright, innocent face of a girl. I know a man well under middle age whose face is drawn into inharmonious contours. The one is the result of a sweet and sunny disposition. The other is the outcome of passion and discontent. As you cannot have a sweet and wholesome home unless you admit the air and sunshine freely into your rooms, so a strong body and bright, happy, or serene countenance can only result from the free admittance of thoughts of joy and goodwill and serenity. On the faces of the aged, there are wrinkles made by sympathy, others wrought by strong and pure thought, and others carved by passion. Who cannot distinguish them? With those who have lived righteously, age is calm, peaceful, and softly mellowed, like the setting sun. I have recently seen a philosopher on his deathbed. He was not old except in years. He died as sweetly and peacefully as he lived. There is no physician like a cheerful thought for dissipating the ills of the body. There is no comforter to compare with goodwill for dispersing the shadows of grief and sorrow. To live continually in thoughts of ill will, cynicism, suspicion, and envy is to be confined to a self-made prison. But to think well of all, to be cheerful with all, to patiently learn and find the good in all, such unselfish thoughts are the very portals of heaven. And to dwell day by day in thoughts of peace towards every creature will bring abounding peace to their possessor. There was a gal friend that I had in high school, and she told me that she loved being around her grandfather. And I said, well, tell me what you like. What's so cool about your grandfather? And she says, well, when he smiles, he's smiled so much over his life that all the wrinkles in his face come from smiling. So when he smiles, his whole face lights up with this vast experience of smiles. So this is a man who's, you know, had a lot of joy and a lot of happiness and expressed that. And he conveys that, and she says she could see it in his face. And so he loved that. It also reminds me of when Mother Hamilton met Mother Teresa of Calcutta?
Of Calcutta, yes.
Yes. And he said, you know, she was a homely woman, but she had so much light coming out of her face that it made her attractive. And we've run into that kind of a person before, where perhaps they don't look the part of a movie star or some picture that you would see, but they have so much light, they have so much magnetic goodness that you can't help but be drawn to them. And often these people often have a high energy, a vitality, a life about them that's just contagious. You know, you might listen to this and you think, well, I can think of so many exceptions. I can think of saints who have gotten sick. Ramana Maharshi had throat cancer. Mother had her strokes and she had all kinds of physical ailments. But keep in mind that those are working out the karma of the world. And the person themselves, if you looked at them, they had this tremendous light about them, even though their physical body wasn't doing as well. And so I think we can take a great lesson here from James Allen in this regard about keeping positive thoughts and keeping an idea that we are all health, we are all vitality. Jerry Trofimchuk has different sign-offs to the bottoms of his emails, and I always get a big kick out of them. And he finds really good ones, but he had one at one point that said something like, I do not exude joy. I am joy itself. I do not exude adventure. I am adventure itself. And this is a mindset. We are not healthy. We are health itself. We are manifesting that from God. And I think one of the easiest ways to change your life and change your attitude, sometimes it's hard to remember all the do's and don'ts, but one of the easiest ways is to simply put our minds on God. And God represents everything that is good in this world, everything that is good in the spiritual world, everything that is good in higher consciousness. So when you put your mind on God, you automatically elevate your consciousness, your thinking, your mind, and you elevate it into positive arenas, and you leave behind this negative and these thoughts of weakness and doubt. So it's an easy way to become upliftment. It's lifted. It's an easy way to have health and vigor and vitality is to put our minds on God. So this next chapter is called Thought and Purpose. And one of the things that's interesting to think about when you read this and you read his thoughts on thought and purpose is I always think of Master. And one of the things that that was very characteristic of Master was his incredibly strong will. And from an early age, he exhibited this. There's many stories in the autobiography. There's the story of his sister, Nalina, and him creating a boil on his arm of her being on the second, on the veranda, the second story veranda of their home. And they were flying their kites. And he talked about his force of will drawing her kite to him, even after the string had broke. And it's just fascinating how he used his will. And then we think of Mother, and one of the greatest characteristics of Mother, probably her most salient characteristic, was her incredibly strong will. She was, in that sense, the toughest person I have ever met in my life, before or since. And we think of David and David's will. David was tough. I don't think you can go to God without being tough, without having a will. So as we read James Allen's observations on thought and purpose, think of it in terms of, you know, he says it can be applied towards any endeavor, but think of it in terms of applying it to the spiritual path and wanting God and wanting that greater spiritual life and that greater spiritual experience. So he says, until thought is linked with purpose, there is no intelligent accomplishment. With the majority, the ship of thought is allowed to drift upon the ocean of life. Aimlessness is common vice, and such drifting must not continue for him who would steer clear of catastrophe and destruction. They who have no central purpose in their life fall easy prey to petty worries, fears, troubles, and self-pityings, all of which are indications of weakness, which lead just as surely and deliberately to plan sins, as deliberately as plan sins, though by a different route, to failure, unhappiness, and loss, for weakness cannot persist in a power-evolving universe. A man should conceive of a legitimate purpose in his heart and set out to accomplish it. He should make this purpose the centralizing point of his thoughts. It may take the form of a spiritual ideal, and that's what we're talking about, or it may be a worldly object, according to his nature at the time being. But whatever it is, he should steadily focus his thoughts, forces upon the object which he has set before him. I think this happens with young people quite a bit when they fall in love with somebody or they become obsessed with somebody. They just put all their focus and their energy on that person. And lo and behold, oftentimes they end up together. This force of magnetic attraction. He should make this purpose his supreme duty and should devote himself to its attainment, not allowing his thoughts to wander into fleeting fantasies, longings, and imaginings. This is the royal road to self-control and true concentration of thought. So when I'm reading these words, I can hear Master talking about the importance of will and Mother talking about the importance of will. And David talking about the importance of focus. When we meditate, we focus. So much of what we accomplish in life, and certainly on the spiritual path, has to do with our ability to concentrate. Even if he fails again and again to accomplish his purpose, as he necessarily must until weakness is overcome, the strength of character gained will be the measure of his true success. So in our striving, we're improving ourselves. And David assures us this is what we get to take with us when we leave this body behind. All of the work that we've done on our own character. And that is what James Allen is talking about here. Even if he fails again and again to accomplish his purpose, the strength of character gained will be the measure of his true success. And this will form a starting point in his life for future power and triumph. Those who are not prepared for the apprehension of great purpose should fix their thoughts upon the faultless performance of their duty, no matter how insignificant their task may appear. Only in this way can the thoughts be gathered and focused, and resolution and energy be developed, which being done, there is nothing which may not be accomplished. Have you ever witnessed somebody doing a mundane task? I remember once I was at an airport and I had a little bit of time to kill, and I was dressed in my nice business clothes. I was going to speak somewhere, I think. And I decided I would have my shoes shined. And I went and I sat down, and they used to have these all over the airports. I think some airports still do, although people don't get their sneakers shined so much, and that's what people seem to be wearing now. But I had my dress shoes on, and I sat down, and I watched this young man do the most incredible job on my shoes. And he would snap his little towel, and he had a routine down, and he was so darn good. And I thought to myself, you know, most people would think that shining a pair of shoes is just this menial, mundane task. You're down there on your knees, you know, you're working away. And he was so good. He was just so incredible. And that's what James Allen is talking about here. Those who are not prepared for the apprehension of a great purpose should fix their thoughts upon the faultless performance of their duty, no matter how insignificant their task may appear. And boy, that's appreciated out in this world. Somebody doing something, no matter what it is, just extremely well. And of course, you're motivated to give that person, if they're doing a service for you, a really nice tip, because it's obvious that they take pride in their work. And that's very attractive. So James Allen goes on to say, strength grows with purpose. The weakest soul, knowing his own weakness and believing this truth, that strength can only be developed by effort and practice, will thus believing at once begin to exert itself. And by adding effort to effort, patience to patience, and strength to strength, will never cease to develop and will at last grow divinely strong. Mother did a whole talk one time on will. And she said, in order to go to God, you must develop your will. And she talked about it, and she said, you know, if you consider yourself to have a weak will, don't have a lot of willpower, trouble sticking to things, she says to practice it, to practice just like you'd build a muscle at the gym. So start off with something small that you think you can do. You know, I'm not going to have a cookie or a snack for a whole hour. Not going to do it. And you accomplish that. And she said, you set little tasks for yourself that require your will, that require some willpower, and you gradually build it up. And you make it stronger and stronger. And every time you accomplish that task that you set before yourself, your will strengthens just a little bit, until you start having a self-image of having a stronger and stronger will. And that will help propel you forward to do the tougher things in life, and particularly on the spiritual path, to keep our minds on God, to keep our thoughts pure. And so much of what James Allen is talking about here is having that discipline. It has to do with will and focus and keeping our thoughts on the right things. Sometimes distracting thoughts will come. Sometimes thoughts of sensuality or sense pleasures will come that will want to take you off the path and take you off of the thoughts of spirituality. And so this will and this intention is very important on saying, no, I'm not going to focus on that now. I'm going to move that thought along, and I'm going to put my mind on God. This is also very important when we're interacting with others. To take the higher road, when perhaps it would be easy to combat somebody if you feel you've been slighted. As the physically weak man can make himself strong by careful and patient training, so the man of weak thoughts can make them strong by exercising himself in right thinking. This is what Mother was telling us. To put away aimlessness and weakness and to begin to think with purpose is to enter the ranks of those strong ones who only recognize failure as one of the pathways to attainment, who make all conditions serve them, and who think strongly, attempt fearlessly, and accomplish masterfully. And once again, I think about Master in this regard. And if you'll remember, he used to challenge the astronomers. He would say, or the astrologically minded, he would say, I want you to pick a time that is the worst for me to perform, where all the stars are aligned against me, and I will accomplish a difficult task during that time. And he says, you don't let the heavenly bodies determine your course. You determine your course. Master was truly a master of his own will. To put away aimlessness and weakness and to begin to think with purpose is to enter the ranks of the strong ones who only recognize failure as one of the pathways to attainment. Having conceived of his purpose, a man should mentally mark out a straight pathway to its achievement, looking neither to the right nor the left. Doubts and fears should be rigorously excluded. They are disintegrating elements which break up the straight line of effort, rendering it crooked, ineffectual, useless. Thoughts of doubt and fear never accomplished anything, and never can. They always lead to failure. Purpose, energy, power to do, and all strong thoughts cease when doubt and fear creep in. Now, this is a man, when he's talking about these experiences, you know he's experienced them himself. He knows what it's like to have doubts. He knows how detrimental they are, and he knows what it's like to have a strong will and to accomplish your goal. That's what I love about masters and saints, is they're not so far above us that they can't relate to us. They've been through all of this. They've been through it themselves, and they can address exactly what that experience is, that same experience that we ourselves are having. He goes on to say, eliminate doubt and fear. The will to do springs from the knowledge that we can do. Doubt and fear are the great enemies of knowledge. And he who encourages them, who does not slay them, warts himself at every step. He who has conquered doubt and fear has conquered failure. Let's read that again. He who has conquered doubt and fear has conquered failure. Wow. His every thought is allied with power, and all difficulties are bravely met and wisely overcome. His purposes are seasonally planted, and they bloom and bring forth fruit, which does not fall prematurely to the ground. Though allied fearlessly to purpose becomes creative force, thought allied fearlessly to purpose becomes creative force, and he who knows this is ready to become something higher and stronger than a mere bundle of wavering thoughts and fluctuating sensations. He who does this has become the conscious and intelligent welder of his mental powers. Once again, this soul reminds me of Mother and how tough and strong she was. And she just, she was ferocious. She didn't have a lot of room for fear and doubt. I called her on the phone once. I was working at the gallery. I was fairly young. I think I was in my early 30s. And I think I was going through a period of doubt on the spiritual path. And I called her on the phone, and I needed a little encouragement. And I said, Mother, what do you do when doubts creep in? What do you do when you have doubts about the spiritual path? And she said, when I got bit hard, and I've never had any doubt since. And I realized that this was a person to follow. This was a very, very strong will, a great spirit. And if I hitched my wagon to her star, I would surely prosper in a spiritual sense. And so James Allen illustrates this very eloquently, that if we do have fears and doubts, rigorously exercise them. Do what we can to stomp them out, to flush them out, to get rid of them, to reaffirm our goal, our commitment, and what we truly want. And this will bear fruit in our characters. We can change ourselves. We can take that with us. And we can use it to carry us to even higher heights. This next chapter is The Thought Factor in Achievement. All that a man achieves and all that he fails to achieve is the direct result of his thoughts. We're beginning to see a theme here with James Allen. In a justly ordered universe where loss of equipoise would mean total destruction, individual responsibility must be absolute. A man's weakness and strength, purity and impurity, are his own and not another man's. They are brought out by himself and not by another, and they can only be altered by himself, never by another. I think that's a good thing to keep in mind if we think we can go in and fix somebody, if we can change them. There's kind of an old joke that sometimes a woman will get a hold of a man as a project, and she's going to change him and improve him and make him into a gentleman or whatever it is. And perhaps she gets very frustrated when he doesn't come along and comply with these ideas. I was in a little gift shop once. It was, I think, kind of a cowboy store. And they had a little rack of greeting cards. And one of the cards had on it that this is the last time you can change a man. And it showed a little baby in diapers. You could change the diapers, but a little taller order to change someone's character. They are brought about by himself and not by another, and they can only be altered by himself, never by another. Now, we can have influence on each other, and we can seek higher influences, and we can seek higher-minded individuals. We can seek to be around saints and higher-realized people, and that's very important. Influence is very important, but it is very much another matter to actually change somebody. They have to be willing. His condition is also his own and not another man's. His suffering and his happiness are evolved from within. As he thinks, so he is. As he continues to think, so he remains. A strong man cannot help a weaker unless that weaker is willing to be helped. We've seen this so much. And even then, the weak man must become strong of himself. He must, by his own efforts, develop the strength which he admires in another. None but himself can alter his condition. That's actually true. And one of the techniques we can use to alter our condition is to ask God for help. Say, God, I really want this. This is very important. It's important for me to become uplifted. It's important for me to become better. It's important to attain this goal, but I need your help. So this is the one other that we can go to, and it's not really the spiritual masters tell us it's not really the other after all. It's that highest divinity within ourselves. But we go to that divinity and we pray. And we admonish God to help us, to lift us up, to raise our consciousness. It has been unusual for men to think and to say, many men are slaves because one is an oppressor. Let us hate the oppressor. Now, however, there is amongst an increasing few a tendency to reverse this judgment and say, one man is an oppressor because many are slaves. Let us despise the slaves. The truth is that the oppressor and slave are cooperators in ignorance, and while seeming to afflict each other, are in reality afflicting themselves. A perfect knowledge perceives the action of law in the weakness of the oppressed and the misapplied power of the oppressor. A perfect love, seeing the suffering which both states entail and condemns neither. A perfect compassion embraces oppressor and oppressed. He who has conquered weakness and has put away all selfish thoughts belongs neither to oppressor nor oppressed. He is free. A man can only rise, conquer, and achieve by lifting up his thoughts. Isn't that true? It's hard to get more without being more. This is something that is very important for us to keep in mind. A man can only rise, conquer, and achieve by lifting up his thoughts. He can only remain weak and abject and miserable by refusing to lift up his thoughts. I think of Papa Ram Dass and in his outward circumstances, very poor, wandering with nothing but a dhoti and going through India barefooted in all weather conditions and not having anything. If somebody would give him money, he would hand it to the next person that would come. So outwardly very poor, inwardly perhaps one of the wealthiest individuals ever, lifted up in God. So it's so true when you think about it in that context that a man can only remain weak and abject and miserable by refusing to lift up his thoughts. And the converse or the reverse of that is true. By lifting up our thoughts all the way to the highest, all the way to God, we lift ourselves. We lift ourselves into spiritual delight and luxury. Before a man can achieve anything, even in worldly things, he must lift his thoughts above slavish animal indulgence. He may not, in order to succeed, necessarily give up all animality and selfishness by any means, but a portion of it must at least be sacrificed. A man whose first thought is bestial indulgence could neither think clearly nor plan methodically. He could not find and develop his latent resources and would fail in any undertaking. Not having commenced manfully to control his thoughts, he is not in a position to control affairs and to adopt serious responsibilities. He is not fit to act independently and stand alone, but he is limited, however, only by the thoughts which he chooses. So a man is limited by his own thoughts. And I just want to say that this was written, this book was written in 1903. And of course, they use man and he to include all people, all individuals. This includes all of us. There can be no progress, no achievement without sacrifice. And a man's worldly success will occur in the measure that he sacrifices his confused animal thoughts and fixes his mind on the development of his plans and the strengthening of his resolution and self-reliance. And the higher he lifts his thoughts, the more manly, upright, and righteous he will become. The greater will be his success, and the more blessed and enduring will be his achievements. I think of Rajashri, Master's number one disciple, the one that Master picked to succeed him as the head of the Self-Realization Fellowship. And Rajashri had that discipline of mind. He had that intense focus, that concentration. He had built a business empire by having that focus before he met Master. And so when he did meet Master, and Master introduced him to meditation and the concentration on the third eye point, and the complete and total focus on the divine, Rajashri just shot up into the upper spheres right away. The first time they meditated, I think it was for 3 hours in Rajashri's office. He was ripe fruit, dry wood waiting for that flame of Master to come along and introduce him to the divine. But he had already had these disciplines in place. He had already developed that focus, that intense concentration of the mind, the exclusion of all thoughts aside from what you are focusing on. The universe does not favor the greedy, the dishonest, the vicious, although on the surface it may sometimes appear to be so. It helps the honest, the magnanimous, and the virtuous. All the great teachers of the ages have declared this in varying forms. And to prove and know it, a man must persist in making himself more and more virtuous by lifting up his thoughts. You rise and fall by your thoughts. You know what's interesting is since we've been on this little book here, and since I kind of picked it up and rediscovered it, and I reread these chapters, I reread them, and I think about what he's saying here. And it used to be that I would sort of take my thoughts for granted. I would think, you know, as long as I'm doing the big things and right, correctly, and as long as I'm heading in the right direction, I can little entertain little backward thoughts or lower thoughts here and there. And who does it hurt? It's just me. I'm not putting these thoughts into practice. I'm not acting on them. They're just, you know, something, a little something that I'm entertaining here for a moment or two. What is the harm in that? And as I read this book and as I understand the importance of thought and how it manifests in ourselves and in our lives, I realize that keeping a close eye on your thoughts is more important than I thought. It does affect you. It does affect outcomes. It affects those around you. It affects what you do, where you go, what you say. It affects what you put out into the world. It affects your own vibration. So it's very, very important to keep a watch on the garden of our thoughts and not let weeds grow here and there and just go, oh, those weeds aren't harming anybody. They're just minding their own business over there. If you're not careful, they'll choke out the garden. They'll choke out the flowers and they'll create inharmony and imbalance. And that will manifest itself. That will make a difference. You rise and fall by your thoughts. Intellectual achievements are the result of thought concentrated to the search for knowledge or for the beautiful and true in life or nature. Such achievements may be sometimes connected with vanity and ambition, but they are not the outcome of those characteristics. They are the natural outgrowth of long and arduous effort and pure and unselfish thoughts. Spiritual achievements are the consummation of holy aspirations. That's what we're cultivating in ourselves and in our hearts, is holy aspirations, this desire for God, this desire for the divine, the desire for upliftment. He who lives constantly in the conception of noble and lofty thoughts, who dwells upon all that is pure and unselfish, will, as surely as the sun reaches its zenith and the moon its full, become wise and noble in character and rise into a position of influence and blessedness. And we've seen this. We've seen that the people that have discipline in their lives and in their actions and in their thoughts, the world naturally gravitates to them and responsibility naturally gravitates to them, because we intuitively understand that those are the ones that are best able to handle it. Achievement of whatever kind is the crown of effort, the diadem of thought. By the aid of self-control, resolution, purity, righteousness, and well-directed thought, a man ascends. By the aid of animality, indolence, impurity, corruption, and confusion of thought, a man descends. This is why our thoughts are so important. They're subtle, but they're powerful. A man may rise to high success in the world and even to lofty altitudes in the spiritual realm, and again descend into weakness and wretchedness by allowing arrogant, selfish, and corrupt thoughts to take possession of him. We can reach great heights, but we can also slide backward if we're not paying attention. Victories attained by right thought can only be maintained by watchfulness. Many give way when success is assured and rapidly fall back into failure. All achievements, whether in the business, intellectual, or spiritual world, are the result of definitely directed thought, are governed by the same law, and are of the same method. The only difference lies in the object of attainment. So the same laws that allowed Rajasri to succeed at business also allowed him to succeed on the spiritual path. All of that he learned was not wasted. It was used and put to great effect. Once he put his feet on the spiritual path, he made incredibly rapid progress. He who would accomplish little must sacrifice little. He who would achieve much must sacrifice much. He who would attain highly must sacrifice greatly. And sometimes it isn't a huge sacrifice. It's putting away vices and things that have actually held us back. But we do need to let go of something. And that is what he is saying here. This next chapter is called Visions and Ideals. The dreamers, the saviors of the world, as the invisible world is sustained by the invisible, so men, through all their trials and sins and sordid vocations, are nourished by the beautiful visions of their solitary dreamers. A higher vision, a higher ideal. Humanity cannot forget its dreamers. It cannot let their ideals fade and die. It lives in them. It cannot, and it knows them as the realities which it shall one day see and know. Holding out those highest aspirations for ourselves is very important. Composer, sculptor, painter, poet, prophet, sage, these are the makers of the afterworld, the architects of heaven. The world is beautiful because they have lived. Without them, laboring humanity would perish, and certainly perish in the spirit. He who cherishes a beautiful vision, a lofty ideal in his heart, will one day realize it. Columbus cherished a vision of another world, and he discovered it. Copernicus fostered the vision of a multiplicity of worlds, and he revealed it. Buddha beheld the vision of a spiritual world of stainless beauty and perfect peace, and he entered into it. Cherish your visions. Cherish your ideals. Cherish the music that stirs your heart. The beauty that forms in your mind, the loveliness that drapes your purest thoughts, for out of them will grow all delightful conditions. All heavenly environment. Of these, if you but remain true to them, your world will at last be built. He's telling us to maintain our highest visions, keep them foremost in our minds, and always believe that we can attain them, that we can strive, 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 and one day the goal. And we hold that as a great faith within ourselves. To desire is to obtain. To aspire is to achieve. Shall man's basest desires receive the fullest measure of gratification, and his purest aspirations starve for lack of sustenance? Such is not the law. Such conditions can never be. Dream lofty dreams, and as you dream, so shall you become. Your vision is the promise of what you one day shall be. Your ideal is the prophecy of what you shall at last unveil. Dreams beget realities. And this is true, the true value of thought. We think of it as being a ephemeral, like a wisp, like a bit of smoke, that it's here for a moment and then it's gone. And what meaning or weight could it possibly have? But dreams and thoughts beget realities. The greatest achievement was at first and for a time a dream. The oak sleeps in the acorn. The bird waits in the egg. And in the highest vision of the soul, a waking angel stirs. Dreams are the seedlings of realities. Your circumstances may be uncongenial, but they shall not remain so if you but perceive an ideal and strive to reach it. You cannot travel within and stand still without. Oh, that's a good one. You cannot travel within and stand still without. So the yogi that meditates all day, when they open their eyes and they go out into the world, and even when they're sitting there meditating, they're broadcasting the highest vibrations all around them. And when they interact with others, those vibrations can be felt. They can be perceived in an upliftment that comes by just being in their proximity. You cannot travel within and stand still without. Here is a youth hard pressed by poverty and labor, confined long hours in an unhealthy workshop, unschooled and lacking all the arts of refinement, but he dreams of better things. He thinks of intelligence, of refinement, of grace and beauty. He conceives of, mentally builds up, an ideal condition of life. The vision of a wider liberty and a larger scope takes possession of him. Unrest urges him to action, and he utilizes all of his spare time, small though they are, to the development of his latent powers and resources. And I don't know if I've told you this story, but I used to travel to speak for 2 years. In the late 90s, I was speaking in two cities a week, and I was constantly on the road traveling. And we had a little baby at home, a really cute little girl named Ruby. And she was so sweet, and I just wanted to be around her, and I wanted to be around our little family as much as I could. But I was on these airplanes, and I was traveling to different cities 3-4 days a week. I was gone half the time or more, and I didn't like it very much. So every time I got on an airplane, as soon as I could lower my tray table, as soon as it was safe to do that, I'd get out a little legal pad from my carry-on, and I'd put it down on that table, and I would write all the things that I wanted in my life. I wanted to be able to spend more time at home. I wanted to be able to dictate my own hours. I wanted to be able to set my own income. I wanted freedom of movement. I wanted to be able to do this and this and this and this. And I'd write down 8, 10, 12 different things. Then the next flight, I would flip that page over, and I'd start off with a clean sheet of paper, and I would write down all the things that I wanted to manifest in my life on that sheet. And I would do that on every flight until I went through 1, 2, 3 legal pads, filling up every page. And one day I had these at home, and this is after I'd started my own business, and I looked at all these different sheets of paper, and they all essentially said the same things. They had the same things on them, the same goals, the same aspirations. And I realized that once I'd started my own business, that I operated from home and dictated my own hours and worked hard, but it was all being my own boss. And I realized that all of these things that were written down on these pages had come true. And I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed by that. And that didn't come from some seminar, from some self-help book. That came from being dissatisfied with my life and wanting something different. And it's so interesting to see James Allen write this down. And it was almost my exact situation. Here he is. He dreams of better things. He thinks of intelligence, of refinement, of grace and beauty. He conceives of and mentally builds up an ideal condition of life. The vision of a wider liberty and a larger scope takes possession of him. Unrest urges him to action, and he utilizes all of his spare time, small though they are, to the development of his latent powers and resources. Very soon, so altered has his mind become that the workshop can no longer hold him. It has become so out of harmony with his mentality that it falls out of his life as a garment is cast aside, and with the growth of opportunities which fit the scope of his expanding powers, he passes out of it forever. Years later, we see this youth as a full-grown man. We find him a master of certain forces of the mind, which he wields with worldwide influence and almost unequaled power. In his hands, he holds the cords of gigantic responsibilities. He speaks, and lo, lives are changed. Men and women hang upon his words and thoughts and remold their characters. And sun-like, he becomes the fixed and luminous center around which innumerable destinies revolve. He has realized the vision of his youth. He has become one with his ideal. How inspirational that we can create our ideals. We can create our dreams. We can create our highest aspirations. And you too will realize the vision, not the idle wish of your heart, be it base or beautiful, or a mixture of both. For you will always gravitate toward that which you secretly most love. In your hands will be placed the exact results of your own thoughts. You will receive that which you earn, no more, no less. Whatever your present environment may be, you will fall, remain, or rise with your thoughts, your vision, your ideal. You will become as small as your controlling desire, as great as your dominant aspiration. So it's so important we keep the highest of ideals. And what is a higher ideal than one with our Heavenly Father, one with the divine? I love the statement in here that he says, you will always gravitate to that which you secretly most love. Let's fall in love with God. Let's keep God as our highest ideal. And we will be assured that we will attain that ideal. We will be lifted up in that consciousness. When the student is ready, the master will appear. In the beautiful words of Stanton Kirkham Davis, you may be keeping accounts, and presently you shall walk out the door, for that so long seemed to be you, the bearer of your ideals, and you shall find yourself before an audience, the pen still behind your ear, the ink stains on your fingers, and then and there shall pour out the torrent of your inspiration. You may be driving sheep, and you shall wander to the city, naive and open-mouthed, and under the bold guidance of the Spirit wander into the studio of the Master, and after a time he shall say, I have nothing more to teach you. And now you have become a master who did so recently dream of great things while driving sheep. You shall lay down the staff to take upon yourself the regeneration of the world. We follow the master. We study under the master. We adhere to the master. We follow the master. And one day we become the master. We lay down our staff and take upon ourselves the regeneration of the world. What a beautiful thought. There is no such thing as luck. The thoughtless, the ignorant, and the indolent, seeing only the apparent effects of things and not the things themselves, talk of luck, of fortune, and chance. Seeing a man grow rich, they say, how lucky he is. Observing another become intellectual, they exclaim, how highly favored he is. And noting the saintly character and wide influence of another, they remark, how chance aids him at every turn. They do not see the trials and failures and struggles which these men have voluntarily encountered in order to gain their experience. They have no knowledge of the sacrifices these men have made, of the undaunted efforts they have put forth, and the faith they have exercised. And they might overcome the apparently insurmountable and realize the vision of their heart. They do not know the darkness and the heartaches. They only see the light and joy and call it luck. Do not see the long and arduous journey, but only behold the pleasant goal and call it good fortune. Do not understand the process, but only perceive the result and call it chance. In all human affairs, there are efforts and there are results. And the strength of the effort is the measure of the result. The strength of the effort is the measure of the result. Chance is not. Gifts, powers, material, intellectual, and spiritual possessions are the fruits of effort. They are the thoughts completed, objects accomplished, visions realized. The vision that you glorify in your mind, the ideal that you enthrone in your heart, this you will build your life by this. This you will build your life by. And this you will become. Everything that he says applies so beautifully, so completely to the spiritual path. It is by our effort. You know, it's funny. There's a paradox in here because they say, well, we cannot attain God through our own efforts. God comes to us through grace. That's like saying we cannot control the wind. But what we can do is set our sails to catch the wind when the wind comes. And we put ourselves in perfect alignment. We put ourselves in perfect position to catch whatever comes, whatever the divine consciousness comes our way. We put our focus on it. We apply our rigorous thinking to it. We weed out the indolent thoughts, the backwards thoughts, the downtrending thoughts. And we encourage those thoughts of God, upliftment, of being charitable to others, to being kind, to be uplifting, to cultivating hope for the betterment of ourselves, for our highest ideals. And James Allen assures us that those ideals will be realized through our own efforts, and of course, our efforts to align with God. So, if God be with us, who can stand against us? We put God on our side, we strive for God, we put our thoughts on God, we put our minds on God, and we ask God every day to lift us up in his beautiful, loving arms and make us one with him. Before we close, does anybody have any thoughts on this subject? It's so fascinating. This idea that we have so much control, even though sometimes we think we're batted around by circumstances and this has happened to us and that's happened to us, through our own efforts and through our own will, we can manifest the divine, the highest light. It's a beautiful thought. It's a beautiful idea. And it's one we can prove to ourselves in the laboratory of our lives, every single moment of every day, where our thoughts take us, how our thoughts manifest. What are the results? What are the fruits of this thought, the fruits of that, the fruits of this type of thinking? And we choose not to indulge in thoughts that take us downward, even though they may be old habits and old friends. We make through our own observations, we observe that they don't take us where we want to go. They don't lift us up. So we let those thoughts go, and we let those old habit patterns go, and we create and cultivate new habits and new ideals and new upliftment. And we create a beautiful garden within ourselves and are the great beneficiaries of that garden. And we strive and we cultivate with upliftment through meditation, through putting our minds on God, and our entire lives and worlds change all around us. It's a beautiful thing. And here this James has put this into words so eloquently so that we can follow these ideals. So once again, any comments or observations in your own life about how this is manifested? It's wonderful to be with you. So delightful. So delightful to put our minds on the highest and the best. And it has great effect. Great benefit. With those thoughts in mind, please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Oh. Peace, bliss, amen.
Amen.